And look, a rather different tack for Monday Muse this week. We're going to look at our music preferences, all of us. We all have them. And we're going to ask why and for what. Professor Jane Davidson is a music psychologist. She's also a singer, a former opera singer, and has been investigating personality, the sort of thing you and I have, and music preferences, the sort of thing we have too, and the relationship as well between exceptional musicians and their mentors. And she joins us now. Welcome, Jane.
Good afternoon.
This is an extraordinary line of inquiry. Is it that different sorts of people are attracted to different kinds of music, or does that sort of work in some sort of reverse?
Well, these things are always complicated, aren't they?
That the music shapes our personality.
Well, let's just take a few steps back. Okay. I think what's going on at a very fundamental level, at a sort of most basic human communication level, is that there are things in the music signal that have kind of primitive origins in the brain. So at the most profound basic level, we have the stimulus response of the loud noise, yes, which is, of course, meridian music, and we respond to it. Then after that, we have aspects of the music to do with its rhythm, its pulse, which make us connect to it and to other people through it. So if we look at a basic activity like walking down the street, if you're walking with a person, you will walk in time together.
Yes.
So we entrain to one another. If you're listening to a musical stimulus, your heart will adapt to that, your body will move to that pulse. So we have this capacity to entrain with music. But then on top of that, it seems that we have very, very strong episodic memory associations with when we hear music and what it means to us according to a certain context.
But what you're saying, before we get to that sort of memory of things and time and place, and the great capacity music has for recall and there's this thing, though, about music where we like it for reasons that we don't understand.
Well,
I think
that they're not objective things that we know for sure. But I think in terms of theory, there are certainly people who believe that music has had over the evolution of the human a profound effect on regulating human interactions and human behaviours. And although we know that at a sort of fundamental level, language and music are connected. We know that they're separated, but it's a bit sort of chicken and egg situation. But of course, the theory goes that the music predates in the primitive brain the language, and that those kinds of signals and so on and so forth have become more abstracted as music has developed as a separate entity. And my own feeling is that, of course, we do and we are and we be in music in a slightly different way to we are in language, because the meaning of the music is sort of held at the root, and it can have a very strong, powerful effect on us. Whereas the language, we can rearrange the surface of that, and the meaning changes completely. So it strikes me that there's something very profound about music and how we react to it and why we use it. And all you have to do is look at mother-infant interactions to see those what we call prototypical musical behaviours of signal and response about fulfilling needs for that infant that make those kinds of exchanges very important.
And yet for most of us, for most of our lives, music is the thing that we receive, that we don't use ourselves to, as an act of communication.
I was having a discussion with someone about this only a couple of hours ago. Of course, that's culturally determined. That's our culture. That is not the case in many other cultures.
The whole thing of performance, of recording, of making music an art form.
Yeah, Exactly. All these separations out of that kind of activity, although we are specialised in lots and lots of aspects of our lives, and we do, you know, physical movement in an absolute extreme, very high level of achievement as a skill. We do music in that way. We do maths in that way. But there's something for me altogether more everyday and fundamental about music. All of us acknowledge that we can run a bit for the bus and that we can do a little bit of this, that and the other.
Yes.
Somehow in our culture, it's become that we're almost inhibited to make any kind of musical sound, any utterance that's coming from us, because we feel as though that's another thing, that's something that we receive that we don't create. And for me, I would like to get the dialogue going to say that actually we are all capable of creating music and doing it and having very, very meaningful and fulfilling interactions because of it. Going back to my mother-infant interaction,
yes.
I have a wonderful example of a premature baby where the mother was so ill, she was in the intensive care. This baby, just 7 months gestation, was given to the father. He put it inside his shirt to kangaroo it. And that tiny little premature baby elicited a sound, an act of communication that had those proto-musical qualities. Ah! And of course, what did the father do? Oh, he responded, and they had these little interactions. And researchers have shown that they're very important, those kinds of exchanges, to regulating that infant's emotional behaviour. And goodness me, we continue that, even just as listeners, to use music in that way in our everyday lives.
We do, and yet, as we were saying, that the bigger experience that we most of us have with music is it's not passive, but it's listening to someone
mm-hmm.
else's
yeah.
music. And that, because of the way music works as a corporate entity, as a mm-hmm. a very structured thing mm-hmm. in our culture, that limits perhaps the music that we're exposed to. It makes it into a certain kind
yes.
of thing, which is the classical repertoire
yeah.
or what is popular
mm-hmm.
in pop music.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. And again, recently someone said to me, what are your musical tastes? You know, what would be your key song? Well, the fact of the matter is I've had music around me in my life, all my life, many, many different kinds of music. So I can list you a whole bunch of things that are incredibly eclectic and different that other people may not have had that exposure to, or you may say, well, this identifies with my socioeconomic status, my
yes.
lifestyle, my all these things that are pushed at us.
And that other thing you mentioned before about time and place, about
yeah,
recall.
Exactly. Mm. Yes. So, yeah, I'm not disagreeing with you. And, of course, that has influence on social group and who you identify with and the kind of music you listen to. And, of course, people can say, oh, well, you know, teenagers listen to all this terrible music. And we remember in the 50s, people were worried about the revolutionary behaviour of all these teenagers gyrating their hips and listening to rock and roll and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And all this subversive behaviour linked to this music. Well, of course, it's the entire cultural practice, and music is a very important construct in that, certainly in terms of something like teenage identity. And indeed, later in life, people often, as you say, identify with the things that surround music as well as the music itself.
Is it hard to grow? Is it possible to become a person raised on Beyoncé and to get an affection for Shostakovich?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't think these things are
And
mutually...
what are the lines of...
Yeah, I don't think these things are mutually exclusive at all. I mean, any learning process involves exposure to something and interacting and developing a mental map of understanding what's going on. And you can do that through repeated self-exposure with a kind of motivational attitude towards doing it. I do remember when I was studying... I was fortunate enough to spend some time studying exceptionally gifted children. And one boy came into this specialist school environment, and actually he was 14. So rather late, if you think about the development of skills of a classical musician. And he had grown up in a rather interesting home situation where he had just been with his mum, and they'd lived in a community with lots of people. And he had had no exposure to classical music, but there was lots of folk singing and guitar playing going on. And he was interested in that, but didn't particularly interact with it. And he was at school and did a music test because he had to take music and did very badly. And it was the experience of being humiliated by the teacher, which then gave him a motivation to face the challenge of saying, well, I'm going to learn about this. And he started actually on the recorder, the dreaded recorder. But within 2 or 3 years, that boy was at almost a professional standard of playing because his absorption and his dedication to understand the music was so great. And I don't mean that in a formal way of understanding the harmony and counterpoint, although that came later. He understood through repeated listening and playing and trialing his own ideas with it, how to engage with it. And that motivated him to pursue it much, much further.
And what's fascinating across musics is that the thing you mentioned before too about that's almost subconscious effect and language of music, the thing it does that's wired right into our brains, that has the response that the minor key has, the response that the rhythm has, these things which just bring a species-wide emotional response.
And of course there's some cultural filtration on that inevitably. So, you know, a modal system, our key system with major and minor keys and so on, and then musics from other cultures have slightly different percepts, and they depend on the cultural environment you've been brought up in, how much
but
inside
they're poking
those
at similar
get.
Things in our
Absolutely.
Brain.
Absolutely. So some of those things I've mentioned, you know, working from that very primitive kind of startle response, so pitch, height and volume and the rhythm, how fast it's going, whether the melody's going up or down, or it's, you know, in a repetitive monotone, like a chant almost.
Yes.
And they're things that recur across musics. We're talking only about vocal music, actually, as it's happening. But, I mean, these things are right across once we start to engage with instrumental music.
Does having that sort of depth of understanding kill the magic?
Are you talking about for me or for anybody? I don't think so. I mean, look, I have done more empirically based work where you ask people about their responses to music or their perception of something. And of course, the more knowledgeable you are, the more technical your description will be.
Yes.
It doesn't mean to say that
you don't still
feel
love
it and love it and all the rest of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, we need to play your tune, your muse song. And that, I guess, suggests too that notion of the muse, of the influence that can take us to another place with music, that can suggest freshness. Let's explore that a little bit. Tell us about what we're going to hear as well.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say, to be honest, it's not really my muse song in that sense. Why I've picked it is because it has an interesting history. This was originally a sort of early modern song called Plaisir d'amour, composed by Martini, and it was a very popular, indeed, love song. The pleasures of love.
What are we talking about?
This is 18th century. And so it was sort of reinvented and used by Elvis Presley as a song. And I think it's just interesting that there are features, like we were talking about earlier, there are features of this song, the sort of ostinato, steady accompaniment, the plaintive melody that has appeal across all that time, even though it's being sung, delivered, and the instruments being used are very, very different. And of course, we get that a lot, don't we? You know, Sting singing John Dowland. And
yes.
There are many examples. I could have picked any number of them, but I happened to pick this one.
And they're very interesting examples because, I mean, the Sting Dowland thing is extraordinary and tells you across the gap from the 16th century to the 20th, 21st, these things are the same.
Yeah.
They have the same emotional cues, emotional response.
Well, they're the same, or are they the same? Because that's another interesting point. You see, if you go into the details of how those things were performed exactly in their own time, although we've got scores and we know what the instruments more or less sounded like, and we have some idea of how these things were delivered, what we can't do is ever hear them or experience them or really know precisely how they were performed because of the passage of time. But
It'd be nice to imagine that somebody sitting somewhere listening to Dowland or Martini would have had that same emotional response to the music that we have today. Yeah. That is an extraordinary thing.
I agree with that as a broad principle, but the finer details of it is, of course, that people were tuned in to slightly different cultural aspects. And it could be that today we don't quite deliver it in the same way as it was at that time.
That's quite possible.
Yeah.
Less tights, for one thing.
Well, all you have to do is listen to how language and indeed tempi and music have changed since the advent of radio broadcasting. You listen to pre-war, post-war English language delivery, and look how much that's changed to now. So those things transmute themselves. Exactly.
Professor Jane Davidson, music psychologist, singer as well. Now, the original of this, Martini's Plaisir d'Amour, 18th century piece, and we have a version here by someone who you might know somewhat better from the modern era. This is Elvis Presley, Can't Help Falling in Love with You.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't.